last time we were able to get 3 centuries packed in. Tonight we're not going to be that ambitious. We're going to get 2 centuries in. I swear we are. We're going to try. We're going to do the 1200s and the 1300s, both of which are important centuries in the development of the church, so there's a fair amount to cover, but I think we can get this done. We begin with cultural background and church-state relations for the 1200s. And of course, the most important element as far as cultural background goes in the 1200s has got to be the Crusades. We started with the Crusades last time. We saw that the first Crusade was announced by Urban II in 1095. It began in 1097. 2 years later, 1099, the Crusaders had conquered Jerusalem. So it was a surgical strike, I guess they'd say nowadays. And we set up the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem. So we now had a corridor between Europe and the Near East so that pilgrims could return to Jerusalem and visit the holy sites there. That first crusade was wonderfully successful, and the other 8 were not. It was all downhill after that first one. The rest of them were pretty much failures. As you can see, we had a couple last time in the 1100s, the second and third, but those were not very successful. Here we've got the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th Crusades, all in the 1200s. The 4th Crusade is undoubtedly the worst of all the Crusades as far as its impact on history. A crusading army was created out of the Christian kingdoms of the West. They allied with the state of Venice. Venice was not just the city, but the surrounding countryside, against Hungary. So this really wasn't so much a religious war. It was politics. And then the Western Crusaders and the Venetians turned their attention eastward, marched into the Byzantine Empire, and sacked the city of Constantinople. 1204, a date that will live in infamy. Our sacking of Constantinople, temporary overthrow of the Byzantine Empire, they get it back several decades later by kicking the Latins out, is considered unforgivable by the East. When John Paul II, what was it, about 10 years ago, he made that trip and visited several sites in Eastern Christianity, and he got booed. Do you remember that? The main reason he got booed was because of the sack of Constantinople in 1204. This is what the news sources said. They went around and interviewed, why are you booing the Pope? Because he and his fellow Westerners sacked Constantinople in 1204. Long memory, yes. Well, you know, the Muslims still complain that we took Andalusia, which means Spain. They still consider that Muslim territory, which ignores the fact that they took it from Christians earlier, but this is the way things go. So the Fourth Crusading Army, having sacked Constantinople, said, hey, we got it good, and they didn't bother going on to the Near East. A very tragic crusade occurred in 1212. It's not one of the official crusades, but a children's crusade. A French peasant boy, Stephen of Cloyes, leads thousands of children from Marseille, a French port, to the Near East, where they all die of hunger, disease, or are enslaved by the Muslims. The Fifth Crusade, a crusading army attacks Egypt, has little success. Sixth Crusade, it's non-military. The Emperor Frederick II, Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, negotiates a truce with the Muslims, restoring a degree of Christian control of the Holy Land. The Seventh Crusade, led by Louis IX of France, has little success. The Eighth Crusade, also led by Louis IX, is called off when he dies in Tunisia. And the Ninth Crusade, a couple of years later, led by Prince Edward of England, also has little success. Finally, in 1291, Acre, the second major city that had been taken by the Crusaders in the Near East, goes belly up, the last Latin kingdom there. So, put it all together, and what did we accomplish by the Crusades? Not a lot, actually. Heresies. There are 2 major heresies that I associate with the early decades of the 1200s, and both of these get going in that band of territory of southern France, northern Italy, right in there. One of them is called the Kaphari. Another name for the Kaphari, which means pure, pure ones. Another name for them is the Albigensians, because one of the territories in southern France is Albigenses, where they were quite popular. We mentioned them last time. You'll recall I said that they're basically Gnostics in medieval clothing. They consider that there were two gods, one good, one evil. The evil demiurge, secondary god, created the universe. Therefore, matter is evil. Therefore, our bodies are evil. Marriage is evil. Children are evil, which is true on occasion. Yeah? They divided into two levels. There were the upper class Cathari, who called themselves the Perfecti, who were absolute celibates, total vegetarians, wandered around without possessions, and so on. And then there were the lower class, who would not be saved. The second heresy we're going to get to in a minute, that's the Waldensians. But before we do, let's take a look at the Inquisition, which gets started in this period of the early 1200s in order to combat these two heresies, especially the Cathari. The exact date for the origin of the Inquisition is debated. Definitely, it started within this six-year period at the beginning of Gregory the Ninth's papacy. So somewhere between 1227 and 33, the Inquisition begins, and different authors suggest different events during that period as the possible date. In 1231, Gregory the Ninth puts out a constitution called Excommunicamus et Anathematismus, which excommunicates heretics, their friends, and any who fail to report heretics. It provides detailed legislation, which says heretics can have no legal counsel. That sort of makes sense, because if you're a friend of a heretic, you're automatically excommunicated. So if you advocate for a heretic, you're automatically excommunicated. Hence, nobody would. There can be no appeal for them of their convictions, demolition of convicted heretics' homes, life imprisonment for impenitent heretics. Anybody listen to National Public Radio this afternoon? There was a court decision, federal court decision, 2-1, that the Guantanamo prisoners need not have habeas corpus. Gregory the Ninth entrusts the Inquisition to the Dominicans and the Franciscans. We haven't mentioned the Dominicans and the Franciscans because they're going to get started right here near the beginning of the Inquisition also. It's coincidental. They didn't get started because of the Inquisition or vice versa, but the fact that they just got started meant that they were available for Gregory the Ninth to hand it over to them. And throughout the lifetime of the Inquisition up into the 1600s, it's Dominicans and Franciscans, and especially Dominicans, who are in charge of the Inquisition. In 1252, Innocent IV put out a bull called Ad Extirpanda, in which he approved torture to obtain confession, and in which he approved burning at the stake. Tortures include ordeal of water, water gets poured in your mouth until you almost drown, ordeal of fire, the soles of your feet are smeared with grease and then placed next to a fire, the pulley, they would tie your hands behind your back, attach a chain to them, pull you up to the ceiling, and then drop you till you almost reach the ground, and then do that over and over again. The wheel, they would attach you to a large cart wheel, and clubs would beat and break a prisoner. The rack, pulling apart the hands and feet to stretch a prisoner's body. And the stivaletto, kind of ingenious. Each leg would have a board in front and a board in back, tied together on both sides of the leg, and then wedges would be pounded in beside the leg to force the boards to come in until finally the bones break. Various sentences that were imposed on people who were found to be heretical included simple penances, prayers, fasting, scourging, whips, and pilgrimages, self-inflicted whipping, wearing two yellow crosses. I couldn't help but think of exactly Nazi Germany when I saw that. And of course, if you're walking around with a yellow cross, everybody knows you're a heretic, therefore they're not going to hire you. Your kids are going to have a hard time getting married. Neighbors are going to ostracize you. Confiscation of property or destruction of your house. That reminds me of Israel bulldozing Palestinian homes. Prison. The prison diet everywhere in the Middle Ages was bread and water. And burning at the stake. Bernard Guy, Inquisitor of Toulouse from 1311 to 31, is typical. He burned 40 heretics in 15 years. A lot of the inquisitors were scrupulously fair and were good and pious men, bound within the confines of their age and its thinking. Nevertheless, because the inquisitor was both prosecutor and judge, acting in secret without even informing the suspected heretic of the charges, the room for abuse was enormous. And, of course, a lot of abuse occurred. I forget when it was. It was either, somebody maybe will tell me, it was either in 2000 or it was in 2002 that John Paul II had a day of penance for the church. It was like March 20th, 28th or something of that year. And during the service, during the liturgical service, he apologized for the Crusades. He apologized for the Inquisition, various other... Anybody remember this? Yeah, recently. So to whatever extent we have been sinful in the past in these ways, we've asked forgiveness. We continue to have ecumenical councils. One occurs early in the century. That's Lateran Council 4 in 1215. We've got a couple more here in the mid-1200s, Lyons 2 and Lyons 1. Generally speaking, these are all reforming councils. They're primarily trying to reform the church, and despite their good intentions and their good formulations of what needs to be done to fix the church, it never takes hold. The reforms don't take hold. Would that they had, because if they had, we might not have had the Protestant Reformation. Why didn't they take hold? Why did it take a ripping apart of Western Christendom in order for reforms to finally become effective? I think it's because the church is emerging out of the Dark Ages, and it just never really recovered from that, plus original sin, I think, has something to do with it. The Second Council of Lyons in 1274 reaffirmed the filioque as part of the creed. You'll remember that's the statement, and the Son, when we say the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. Eastern Christians disagree with that. At the Council of Lyons, we invited Eastern Christian leaders, the Patriarch of Constantinople, for example, representatives of the Emperor of the Byzantine Empire, who came to the council. And we wrote out a creed which they accepted. So theoretically, we overcame the schism between East and West at this council here in 1274. However, which included the filioque, and which included recognition of the Pope's universal jurisdiction. But when the leaders, why did the leaders come? Because they were hard-pressed by the Muslims and they wanted military help from the West. So that had to do with this agreement. Nevertheless, they agreed, but when they got back home, the populace, the persons in the pews, refused to go along with it. Gothic architecture starts up around this time, really in the 1100s or the beginnings, but it starts to flourish in the 1200s. And in the 1200s, 1300s, 1400s, it's the dominant style. How does it differ from what preceded it? What preceded it was called Romanesque. We looked at that last time. Romanesque had curved arches. Gothic has pointed arches. Romanesque had very thick walls, so it looked almost like fortresses. Gothic tries for an airier, lighter feel with thinner walls, but then it has to put these flying buttresses out to shore up the walls and make sure they're not, the roof is not going to force them flat. Stone fretwork. You've seen the little stone curlicues and filigrees at the tops of the arches and so on. All of that's Gothic style. The semicircular apse that's behind the altar, the short top of the cross, so to speak, goes from semicircular in Romanesque to polygonal in Gothic. There's an effort to sweep the soul of one who enters a Gothic church upward. And so ceilings go very high and steeples are very high. The most common Gothic church that you're familiar with is Notre Dame. Also, the primary way of depicting Christ in a Romanesque church had been Christ the King. So you might have a cross, and you'll have a corpus, the body of Christ, on it, but he'll be dressed in a robe, he'll have a crown on his head, and he'll have his hands up as if in prayer or blessing. that's Christ the King. That's the typical way of depicting Christ in the 700s, 800s, 900s, 1000s. When we get to the Gothic, you switch to the crucifix, and it's the Man of Sorrows that people meditate upon in this period. Why do you suppose that was? That's not a trick question. I don't know either. The only thing that occurs to me is the Black Death. In a three-year period, from 1348 to 1351, one-third of Europe died. I mean, can you imagine if that happened in the United States in the next 3 years? 100 million out of our 300 million people die. That would be mentally traumatic. So Christ's suffering would give us a sense of God knowing what we're going through. I'm just suggesting, I don't know if this is true or not, but that might be one reason why. The only problem with that theory is we're talking mid-1300s, which is a bit late. So there must have been more going on than that that caused this interest in the crucifix rather than Christ the King. We're starting to see some instances of the resurrected Christ in churches. Have you seen that? Rather than a crucifix. So I don't know what's going on there. Religious orders. Well, if you look at B, 1209, the Franciscans begin. We're all familiar with St. Francis. He was a rich and somewhat spoiled upper-class kid who caroused and enjoyed life and then gave it all up for poverty, wound up with the stigmata and so on. He begins the Franciscans. Innocent III gives the Franciscans verbal approval in 1209, the official approval somewhat later. So there's always been a kind of one-upmanship between the Franciscans and the Dominicans. We were first. No, we were first. It all depends on whether you want to go by the verbal or the published, because the Dominicans are shortly afterward. They're in 1216. St. Dominic is a Spaniard who noticed that there was terrible ignorance of Christianity among the ordinary people in Christendom. So he started up an order of preachers, which is the technical name for the Dominicans, order of preachers. When I was a teenager, I remember coming across a guy's name, Father so-and-so, comma, O-P. And I thought, well, gee, it must mean that guy's out of print. And then later on, I figured, oh, no, actually, that's Order of Preachers. 520s. They were the only ones for a long time. They had a lock on it. Yeah. They had a lock on it until the 900s, or, 1100s, with Citeaux and the Cistercians break away from them. Benedict. I'm sorry. He asked when the Benedictines started, and I said 520s. Some other orders start, not as important, ultimately. One of them is called the Beguines. Da, 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 da. Begin the Beguine. This name, we're not sure where it comes from. It might come from Albigensians, because they seem to have been somewhat influenced by the Albigensians. And Begin might be where Beguine comes from. Or it might have to do with a woman's gown of undyed wool, which in French was called a beige. That's where we get our word beige. Groups start to appear in the town, French town of Liège, around 1185. In 1200, pious women assemble around a mystic named Marie of Wagner. 1233, Gregory IX places the Beguines under papal protection. And women who couldn't get into the Cistercians or the Premonstratensians, those Augustinian orders we talked about last time, would become Beguines. They don't have a rule, and they don't have necessarily vows of poverty and obedience, but they do take vows of chastity, and they lead a common life in community together, where they help the sick and the poor, and they also seek ecstatic, visionary experiences. This is a characteristic not so much of the 1200s, although it's there, but especially the 1300s and 1400s. There's a lot of desire for mystical experience, and these Beguines are an example of that. We're going to come across mysticism again a bit later. There was a male counterpart to the Beguines, although they were never nearly as numerous. Those were the Begards, and there was a related group of men called the Brethren of the Free Spirit, or the Free Spirits. Unfortunately, they started to involve themselves in some heretical beliefs. Consequently, they wound up being suppressed by Urban V in 1364. They the order of suppression comes out and they gradually die away, but there's even some still around when the Reformation occurs in the early 1500s. Military orders get going. The first is the Knights Templar, which technically starts in 1119, so you might ask, well, why didn't I talk about that last time? Actually, we alluded to them last time, but they peaked. Their primary years, their mature years, are in the 1200s, so I associate them with the 1200s primarily. They're called Templars because in 1119, this one fella, Hugh of Payon, talked eight of his fellow knights who were down there fighting the crusade into forming a religious community where they would, in addition to being soldiers, they would also live together and take the vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience. They also took a fourth vow, which was to protect pilgrims. The knights, I'm on top of page 5, the knights had to be of noble birth. Commoners were admitted only to serve the knights and the sick. Priests were only admitted insofar as they were needed to do the sacraments. Their habit was the Cistercian white mantle, but they put a red cross on it. And here's the origin of the red cross. King Baldwin II, we now have a Latin, having conquered Jerusalem, we now have a Latin kingdom of Jerusalem with the city and its near environs. So the king of that city-state, King Baldwin II, assigns to the Templars a dwelling on the Temple Mount, where the temple had been, and hence they become known as Templars right now. Right, yes. He said same location as Dome of the Rock right now. One of their number, Bernard, writes a book, De Laude Novae Militiae Ad Milites Templi, which becomes a, quote, bestseller of the Middle Ages. And as a result, the Templars become exceedingly popular, romantic figures, off fighting the wars in exotic places. And as a result, all kinds of gifts come in, flow into the Templars, and they become wealthy and powerful. So wealthy and powerful that their temple, their headquarters, in Paris, becomes the bank of Europe in the 1200s and 1300s, early 1300s. A second military order is the Hospitallers, so-called because when they formed, they were given a hospital in Jerusalem to be in charge of. They were knights, so this is a military order, but they also took care of the sick. In fact, they get going somewhere around 1100. In 1137, they distinguish between the knights and the nurses. So kind of like the Templars, they have the equestrian class and they have the commoner class within the order. A third group is the Teutonic Knights. Teuton was an ancient word for German, so these are knights of German origin. Whereas the Templars were international but primarily French, and the Hospitallers were international but primarily French, the Teutonic Knights are almost entirely Germans. Some German merchants gave them a hospital at Acre. They also expanded and wound up going back to the mother country and founding lots and lots of monasteries there. They engaged in attempts to convert some Central Asian nomads known as Cumans, I'm at the bottom of page 5, who had entered Ukraine, Moldavia, Wallachia, Transylvania. They also undertake the conversion of the Prussians, who up until this time are still worshiping the German gods and goddesses. But alas, in 1291, the Muslims reconquer Palestine. And so the knights can no longer have Jerusalem as their headquarters. They wind up moving it to two or three, four different places over the next couple of centuries. In 1805, they wind up moving to Vienna, and that's where they're headquartered today. It's entirely a hospital order now, not a military order, and not a very large one, I don't believe. Theology in the 1200s. You'll recall last time in the 1100s, we talked about the rise of universities. The earliest university was the University of Paris, somewhere around 1175. The second was the University of Bologna, around 1195. Oxford and Cambridge get founded somewhere around 1200. We're not We don't have historical records to be exact. And then it expands from there till we have, what did we say we had by 1500? 70 universities or something? I forget the exact number. So, with this rise of universities, you're going to get an elevation of scholarship, and this we refer to as scholasticism. The primary thing that we associate with scholasticism is Aristotle. Aristotle wrote lots of works. I don't know, a couple dozen are in the Aristotelian canon set of books. Most of those, however, were lost at the beginning of the Dark Ages. We still had his Posterior Analytics, a book on logic. We still had the Meteorological on weather. You have a few little things like this. But of most of his works, we lacked. Well, when the Muslims came in and conquered Greece, they came in contact with these works, and they set up a house of interpretation, they called it. House of translation in the 700s, 800s, where they translated all of these works from Greek to Arabic. The Jews in Spain, who were living under the Moors, the Muslims in Spain, got hold of these Arabic translations and translated them into Latin for their use. So with the Crusades and the Crusaders expanding out into Muslim countries, they come into contact with these things. And so Aristotle finally infiltrates into Western Europe in the 1100s, and therefore has a major impact on the scholarship of these newly founded universities. Actually, when Aristotle first showed up, because he was a pagan, and because it wasn't immediately obvious how his ideas could be reconciled with Christian doctrines, Aristotle was banned. We didn't have what was called the Index back in the 1100s, 1200s. That's a later invention. But in effect, they were put on the index. These are works that you are not to read. But nevertheless, as it says a fourth of the way down, although banned, Aquinas reads Aristotle's works. So Tommy was a naughty boy. And we're lucky he was, because he saw how to reconcile Aristotle, the true and good aspects of Aristotle's thought, with Christian revelation. Major scholastics include, in addition to Aquinas, Alexander of Hales, Albert the Great, Bonaventure, Duns Scotus. You'll notice they're all Franciscans and Dominicans. So as soon as these universities got going, then the Franciscans and Dominicans are founded, and being new kids on the block, they flock to this new technology, so to speak, of the universities. Baptism has an interesting development in the 1200s, 1300s. Up until this time, in the West, baptism has been by immersion. So if you were a Christian born, let's say, in 700, you would have been baptized by dunking. We don't do that much anymore. When did it switch? Well, it was right around the 1200s here, 1100s, 1200s. We started to do infusion, which means pouring on the head, and we started to do aspersion, which means sprinkling. In the East, baptism is still by immersion, though the person is not dunked but sits in water as the water is poured on the head. Excuse me? They being the West, why did they switch from immersion to these? I don't know. You've seen that? So I don't know. That's your homework assignment for next time. So you find that out for us. What about the sacrament of reconciliation or confession? What's going on there? Well, casuistry starts up. Casuistry means case-based moral reasoning. So we invent a situation. Like, let's suppose that somebody has been in a car wreck, has severed the spinal cord, and therefore is unconscious and likely never to recover. What would be the Christian moral thing to do in a situation like that? This is how casuistry works. You make up hypothetical cases, and then you work out, based on the principles of moral theology, what the proper response in that situation would be. So big books of casuistical reasoning start to replace those penitential books from the 600s, 700s, which was what the priests had used for centuries. you go to a priest and confess, and then he looks up what your penance should be in these penitential books. But now that's old hat, and we use these new casuistical reasonings.
How were those books, the penitential of the 600 and 700s, written if it wasn't think tankish like you're talking here? Was it basically this priest gave penance for this, let's log that down, this priest gave penance for this? Was it constructed pretty much that way?
Yeah, I don't think they gave reasonings. Basically, they said, if your penitent has done such and such, shoplifted, then if this is the amount he took, here's the penance. If this amount he took, here's the penance. I didn't really get into the reasoning of it. I believe that's the case. Frequency of confession is about once a year back then. Lateran Council 4, which was an ecumenical council, and this is still in force, requires every Catholic to confess at least once a year to one's parish priest. In the East, I'm at the bottom of page 6, confessors for a number of centuries were laypersons rather than priests. You would go to a holy monk, and this actually happened in the West for a while. Confessing to a deacon or a cleric in minor orders became common if you didn't have easy access to a priest. Top of page 7. Some theologians in the 1100s, excuse me, in the 1000s, I apologize, say that in case of necessity, when a priest is not present, you should confess to a layperson. Some said, well, that's even obligatory. You have to confess to a layperson if there's no priest available. Albert the Great and Thomas Aquinas said that a layman's absolution has a sacramental effect. But then the tide turned shortly after Aquinas, and the Franciscans argued, no, only a priest's confession has the sacramental effect, and so that practice of using a layperson to confess to dies out. Under Eucharist, preaching improved, mostly because of the Dominicans and Franciscans. Frequency of Masses, Lateran Council 4 complains that many priests and bishops hardly celebrate Mass even 4 times a year. Frequency of reception, the average Christian in the 1200s took communion about 3, 4, 5 times a year. Lateran Council 4 in 1215 requires that all Catholics confess at Easter, a worthy confession, which means one following communion with communion preceding it. Not necessarily immediately. Certain feasts become popular in the century we're considering. These include the Feast of Corpus Christi. It started in the Diocese of Liège in 1246. In 1264, the Bishop of Liège winds up Pope, so he says, everybody ought to do this. And so it spreads, and you wind up with the processions on Corpus Christi with the Eucharist and so on that occur in some countries now. Devotions to Mary, page 8. Devotion to Mary has always been strong, both in the East and the West. Now that we've got these scholars who are sitting in their university offices thinking about things, they come up with a justification for the exceptional veneration of Mary. They distinguish between 3 things. First of all, there is dulia. Dulia means veneration or respect. Contrasted with it is latria, which means adoration or worship. Now, you should not adore or worship a saint. You restrict adoration or worship to God. But in between these two, they distinguished from latria, or from dulia, excuse me, hyperdulia, which means especial veneration or devotion. The Immaculate Conception gets a boost at this time. It had been around in the 700s. The East celebrated the feast on December 8th. England and France celebrate it in the 1000s and 1100s. In 1263, the Franciscans promote the devotion to the Immaculate Conception. The Dominicans, on the other hand, oppose it. But, of course, the Franciscans turned out to be right, and the doctrine is defined in 1854 by Pius IX. The Salve Regina. Salve, I'll spare you the rest, gets invented at this time, about 1050. Prior to 1200, ordinary prayers of the faithful are mostly the Our Father and the Apostles' Creed. But now various other prayers as devotions begin to arise. There's the text of it. St. Bernard is especially associated with spreading devotion to the Salve Regina. Cistercians, Dominicans, Franciscans all add it to their Liturgy of the Hours. And then Gregory IX prescribes its universal use. In 1884, Leo XIII prescribed that it was to be recited after every low mass, one that's not real fancy, and that's still in force. Have you ever done that? I've never done that. I've never done the Salve Regina after a mass. No, the Salve Regina. Yeah, the Hail Mary, that occurs, but... Oh, hey, and that's next. Go ahead. Have you? The Ave Maria gets invented about this time, around 1200. Originally, it consisted only of the two statements of Elizabeth in her greeting during the visitation, and that's... one by Gabriel, one by Elizabeth. Gabriel says, "Greetings, favored one, the Lord is with you," or "Hail Mary, full of grace." Elizabeth cries at the visitation, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb." And around 1260, they add the name Jesus, "Blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus." In the 1400s, the second half is invented and added to it. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. In 1563, the entire prayer in its present form is in the earliest printed version that we've come across. And then in 1650, the prayer comes into general use throughout the church. Are you surprised how late that is? Oh, I am too. I was quite surprised when I saw that. The Rosary. Prior to the 1100s, the Cistercians, Dominicans, and Third Orders used beads on strings to count Our Fathers. They'd say 50 Our Fathers, 100 Our Fathers, 150 Our Fathers, in imitation of the 150 Psalms in the Book of Psalms, which they would recite in the Liturgy of the Hours. In the 1200s, after the invention of the Hail Mary, they started adding some Hail Marys to the Paternosters, the Our Fathers. In the 1300s to 1400s, meditation on mysteries of Jesus and Mary's lives become essential to the devotion. And around second half of the 1500s, the present rosary, with 5 or 15 decades, each decade being one Our Father and 10 Hail Marys, accompanying 5 or 15 mysteries, becomes universally popular. Loreto, you all heard of the house at Loreto? Supposedly, well, it says it right here under A. In 1291, when the Muslims retook Palestine, the story got going that angels had picked up the house that Mary, Joseph, and Jesus had lived in prior to his public ministry and flew it originally to Yugoslavia, and then across the Adriatic Sea to Loreto, which is on the east coast of Italy. In 1908 and 1909, a Franciscan archaeologist, Prosper Biot, studied the Church of the Annunciation at Nazareth and says that the Santa Casa, the Holy House, at Loreto cannot have been part of the original House of Mary, and cannot have come from the east. Nevertheless, Loretto became, and I suppose still is, a favored pilgrimage spot. Devotion to saints is mentioned in the last line of page 9. We saw last time that Nine sixty-three? I don't know. Some date in the 900s was the first time that a pope had canonized a saint. Remember that? Up until then, it was all kind of custom and all that. Well, here we've got 1234. Gregory the Ninth reserves canonization of saints to the papacy. So you cannot any longer have spontaneous arisals of saints. Hagiography. Hagios means holy in Greek, so, and grapho means to write. So these are lives of saints. Lives of saints, often legendary, are very popular. They stress confidence in God, asceticism, and a belief in the miraculous. Another aspect of devotions that's important in the 1200s is relics, which have been important for centuries. But the Fourth Crusade, when it sacked Constantinople, also ransacked the churches and took all the relics out of the reliquaries of the Eastern Christians and shipped them off to the West. So a flood of unauthenticated relics suddenly came into the West. A good example is the shrouds. We're all familiar with the Shroud of Turin, but actually, shortly after the sacking of Constantinople, there were 40 churches in the West who claimed to have the shroud. And none of them, of course, could authenticate it. The Shroud of Turin, I hadn't realized this. I'm about 7 or 8 lines up from the bottom of page 10. In 1390, Clement VII, in a bull, declares that the image on the shroud is a painting by someone unknown. In the 1980s, a scientific committee in Cambridge studied the shroud with the Vatican's permission and announced that it was a painting. But since then, others have continued studying the shroud and have said, wait a minute, it's created by radiation, or there's other theories. It's still an unsettled question. And you're free to use the shroud as a devotion if you wish. I love the shroud myself. Asceticism, top of page 11. Groups of flagellants become popular in the 1200s. Again, this has got to have something to do with the new interest in the crucifix, in the crucified Christ. And this also is prior to the Black Death, so it's not just that major plague that caused it. But people, groups of monks and penitents, are wandering around Europe whipping themselves. You're smiling. I know what you're thinking of. You're thinking of that Monty Python movie. What is that movie? Search for the Holy Grail, yes, right. Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail. Mysticism becomes a major fad, a major interest among Christians in the 1200s and especially the 1300s. Various nuns have visions. Mechtilde of Hockeborn, Gertrude the Great, Mechtilde of Magdeburg, Angela of Foligno, a Third Order Franciscan, in 1285 began to receive visions, and her confessor wrote them down. That's now called the Book of Visions and Instructions. And this continues to recur later on in church history. Mel Gibson, they say, used some book of visions to help him in the writing of the script for The Passion of the Christ. Anybody heard that? But I can't remember whose. Catherine Emmerich, I believe it was. She was the nun in Germany, early 1900s maybe, or late 1800s, who went for years without eating any food, just took the Eucharist daily. She had a book of visions. But I don't. Now that I think of it, I don't think it's her. Somebody. He used that to supplement the biblical material and was criticized for having done so. Sculpture is rare in the first 1,000 years of the church, mostly because of the concern with that first commandment in the Ten Commandments, no graven images. But once painting was accepted, as it became to be with the Romanesque and the turn of the millennium, then sculpture gets going and flourishes in the Gothic churches. Lots of sculpture. All right, ready for the 1300s? Our second century for the night? Cultural background. A pope, I forget who, in 1309, gets elected. He happens to be French, and he's persuaded by the French king to move the papacy from Rome. So he and the curial court pulled up stakes, crossed the border into France, and settled at a city or town called Avignon. They stay there for the better part of the 1300s. You were asking about this last time. Yeah, here it is. They stay there until 1377. The person who is instrumental in finally persuading the seventh of these French popes to knock it off and go back to Rome is St. Catherine of Siena. Another major event in the 1300s is the Hundred Years' War. That's the one that Joan of Arc is involved in. And third major event of this century has to be the Black Death. In 3 years, bubonic plague kills one-third of the population of Western Europe. Heresies. The Franciscans, unfortunately, rupture during this time. Even prior to St. Francis' death in 1226, there were certain Franciscans who said, you have to follow what St. Francis says in our rule to the letter. And others who said, well, it's an ideal that we're supposed to strive for, but not necessarily something you have to do. So it became an argument over absolute poverty. Must Franciscans own nothing, absolutely nothing? Or can they own a modest amount of properties and monasteries and so on to allow them to do their mission? Well, the spiritual Franciscans is the name given to the ones who argued for absolute poverty. In Italian, they were called the Fraticelli, or the Little Brothers. The Little Brothers were actually favored for a while by the popes, but unfortunately, they became more and more strident, and as they became strident, they also became heretical. You'll notice two-thirds of the way down page 12, at number 5, in 1323. Why does that always happen at this time of night? 8:30. Why doesn't it happen at 7:30? At night? Oh, that's for 8:30 in the morning when the kids get here. Get to your rooms. Oh, okay. In 1323, John the 22nd declares heretical the assertion that Christ and the apostles possessed no poverty, or absolute poverty, and therefore had no possessions. So, yep. From that point on, the spiritual Franciscans begin to die out, wind up joining various heretical groups, and the remaining Franciscans become called the conventuals because they live in convents that they own. I had a spiritual director 25 years ago who was a conventual Franciscan. Wonderful guy. He wound up, I knew him up in Wisconsin, he wound up going to Honduras as a missionary. And he had a little motorcycle. His parish was 900 square miles, mostly unpaved. And he'd ride up on trails into these villages and so on. Anyway, page 13. Yes, sir.
Why would the church be concerned to rule heretical the notion that Jesus and the apostles had no property? I don't get a connection here at all.
Because the spiritual Franciscans had reached the point where they said we're the only true Christians. Oh. Remember I said they were becoming heretical?
Strident. Yeah, just strident. Yeah.
Well,
and I
said,
wondered what...
So yeah, as they became strident, they also became heretical. Yeah.
Because they proclaimed the only way you could be true Christians is if you had no property?
Right.
Like them.
Skip his comment. Okay, page 13. Wycliffe. John Wycliffe was an English priest and a professor of scripture at Oxford. Lived within the 1300s. He was influenced by the spiritual Franciscans. He says, for example, that priests and bishops who possess church property are in a state of sin, and therefore forfeit jurisdiction. You don't have to pay any attention to them. He says a superior in a state of sin has no authority over his subjects.
Well, let's say that I'm your bishop. Am I in a state of sin or am I in a state of grace? You can't tell. Not even I know for sure. Trent says you can't know for absolute certainty without a special revelation. So if you're going to say that only bishops who are in a state of grace need to be paid attention to, how do you know which ones those are? You don't. So in effect, he's denying the visibility of the church, which is what he wanted. Get rid of the institutional church. Wycliffe denies the divine institution of the papacy and of the episcopacy. He says that the church's judgment in matters of faith and morals is unnecessary. Private interpretation of scripture and individual conscience are the only theological criteria. Where have we heard that? Protestantism. Right. And we're getting close, aren't we? We're in the middle of the 1300s here. It's only 150 years before Luther shows, yeah. So 1300s, 1400s, you can sort of see a building up toward Protestantism. Wycliffe sends out missionaries to proclaim his ideas. They became known as Lollards. This word Lollard comes from a Dutch word which means to mumble or to mutter. I guess that means they didn't speak distinctly. Or maybe it means they go on and on and on. I wish they'd stop ringing my doorbell. Wycliffe produced an English translation of the Bible. I believe it came out in 1381. And in it, he produced footnotes to various verses to promote his ideas, these ideas that we just looked at. Consequently, the church ruled that the Bible needs to be restricted in the hands of the laity. So when the Protestants come along, about 100 years later, this is one of their complaints. You're not giving the Bible to everybody. But the reason for that was because there were heretical editions out there.
There's a copy of that Bible at the British Museum in London.
He said he just saw it.
Just saw it within about the last 18 months. When I was
wow. There. Is that neat?
In the 1500s, the Lollards simply disappear into the Protestants because, after all, they're not that far from them. But they do have an influence. In 1382, I'm two-thirds of the way down page 13, King Richard II of England marries a princess of Germany and Bohemia. And consequently, since you got an English king and a Bohemian princess, Oxford exchanges professors with the University of Prague. And so Wycliffeite professors go from Oxford to Prague, and here's the connection between Wycliffe and the Lollards and Hus and the Hussites. Don't we come to Hus next? No, I guess not. He's the 1400s. He'll be next week. So tuck that away. We'll mention that next time. Page 14, religious orders. In the early 1300s, the Templars are squashed. They are quashed. What happened was the King of France wanted all of their wealth. They had the Bank of Europe, sure, and he wanted it. Of course, it was located right there in Paris. So how did he go about getting it? Well, with charges of heresy from a few disgruntled Templars, he tortures many Templars to death. And from others, he obtains confessions. And these confessions say things like, during the secret initiations into being a Templar, you're forced to spit on the cross, you're forced to deny Christ, you're forced to practice sodomy, you're forced to worship idols. Clement V learns of these charges because the King of France immediately informs him. He wants the Templars squashed. And so the Pope says that there ought to be investigations everywhere, but the investigations find them innocent, except in France. In 1310, 54 of the Templars who recant their coerced confessions are burned as relapsed heretics in Paris. So most of the Templars in France make confessions, even though they're saying untruths. In 1311, the majority at the Council of Vienne is opposed to suppressing the Templars. They can see what this French king is up to. But in 1312, Clement V goes ahead and suppresses them anyway. The various royal families in Europe grab what they can. Most of what's left goes to the Hospitallers. The Hospitallers have to leave Palestine when the Muslims retake it, so they wind up with headquarters in the island of Rhodes, one of those Aegean islands off the Greek peninsula. And so they become known as the Knights of Rhodes. Their original name was Knights of St. John, meaning John the Baptist, because that hospital that they began with was the Hospital of John the Baptist. In 1522, the Muslims take Rhodes, so the Knights have to withdraw to Malta, and so they become known as the Knights of Malta. The Reformation and the French Reformation take most of their property, so the small number that exists today are mostly in four little monasteries. There's a general decline of fervor throughout Europe in the 1300s, and various causes of that are listed at the bottom of 14, top of 15. The wars, the wealth of monasteries, many famous old Benedictine abbeys have become residences for noblemen, full of idleness and immorality. The new religious movements run out of steam, and so on. Reforms are attempted throughout this century as they were in the preceding century, but they don't get traction. They don't take hold. There's some new orders in the 1300s. The Hieronymites, the Brigittines, who were founded by St. Bridget, who lived in the 1300s, a Swedish mystic,
After her husband dies, she founds the Brigittines. They're still around. She's another one who has revelations. Take a look at the top of page 16. Third line is Bridget's revelations. The status of her revelations caused a theological controversy. But in 1431 to 49, the Council of Basel discusses the matter and makes no decision. In 1750, several centuries after her death, Benedict XIV declares the revelations to be orthodox. Another order that gets going is the Alexian Brothers. I used to live in Milwaukee when I went to Marquette, and there was a old folks home there. It was Alexian Brothers Nursing Home, or whatever it was called. So yeah, they're mostly helping the sick and the poor. Middle of the page, you got Brethren of the Common Life. These are kind of important because they have been seen as a precursor that fed into Protestantism. They were founded by Gerhard Grote, a Dutchman. In 1374, although a wealthy lawyer, he gave up all his possessions. 1381, he becomes a deacon and gathers a group around him. And they practice a new form of devotion that Grote has developed. And so they refer to it as the Devotio Moderna, which is the name we still give to it, even though it's no longer modern. Bottom of page 16 describes it. Grote, influenced by major mystics like Meister Eckhart and Ruysbroek, developed a new form of piety, and it stressed imitating Christ, valuing the interior life, devaluing the church's institutionalized aids to salvation, like sacraments, criticism of formal acts of piety, criticism of naive reliance on the external aspects of religion, like the rosary, insistence that illiterate peasants can know God as easily as scholars. There's a kind of intellectual anti-intellectualism here. Urgency in the face of sinfulness and death. This is post-Black Death. Sorry? Was there a question?
Urgency of what?
Oh, urgency to convert and reform your life, because sickness and death are everywhere around us, so you better shape up. Regular and methodical meditation, I'm at the top of page 17, and intense and emotional meditation on the suffering of Christ. The most famous member of this group, the Brethren of the Common Life, was Thomas A. Kempis. Has anyone heard of his Imitation of Christ? Have you read it? Yeah, I think it's a beautiful book. And I don't recall anything that I would consider heretical in it.
He's okay.
As far as I know, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's St. Thomas A. Kempis.
Thomas A. Kempis, that was his name, right.
Isn't he canonized as a saint? Not, okay.
Not to my knowledge. I could be wrong.
Thomas is mixed up.
I think so, yeah. Anyway, he writes that book, and it's a very popular devotional aid even today. You can easily find it in Christian bookstores. The Brethren of the Common Life found high schools and universities, so they wind up influencing scholars, and they are influential in the development of humanism in the Renaissance, which will be coming too soon. Lots of mystics in the 1300s, bottom of page 13. Bernard of Clairvaux, Hildegard of Bingen, Gertrude, we mentioned, Meister Eckhart, a Dominican, Henry Suso, John Towler, Bridget of Sweden, Catherine of Siena. Some feasts
are invented during the 1300s, including All Souls Day. We had All Saints Day several centuries ago, but now we get All Souls Day. This developed in the 900s in the Cluny Monastery, but in the 1300s, its observance becomes general. The Feast of the Most Blessed Trinity is announced as universal in 1334 by the Pope. The Feast of the Visitation is part of the upswell of devotion to Mary in the Middle Ages. Speaking of devotion to Mary, here's the Angelus. Must develop in the 1300s. Let's see what it says here. In the 1300s, John the 22nd grants an indulgence to all who pray when a bell rings on the eve of a festival. Consequently, the practice spreads rapidly. Mostly, they're going to pray the Our Father or the Apostles' Creed, maybe the Hail Mary. A synod in Prague in 1386 is the first to mention the noonday bell. 1456, the Pope orders churches to ring bells at noon every day to remind the faithful to pray for deliverance from the Muslims. Various prayers are recited, but in 1724, 275 years ago, Benedict XIII grants an indulgence for reciting a particular prayer, the Angelus, at the bell. So ringing the bell three times a day and reciting the prayer becomes common. That, too, surprised me. I thought that was Middle Ages, but in its full, complete form. Here's the text of the Angelus, if you're curious. Page 19 talks about Jubilee years, but since we're running short of time, and that's not one of our most important topics, let's skip it and take a look at, bottom of page 19, asceticism. I've mentioned before that the Greek word askesis means athletic training, and the early Christians borrowed that word to mean restraint of oneself, one's desires, especially bodily desires for drink and food and sex and so on. Well, asceticism, self-denial, repressing the body, becomes common in the 1300s, especially after 1351, which is the Black Plague. Groups of flagellants wander Central Europe. Flagellants become associated with various superstitions. Various letters from heaven are circulating. Rejection of the sacraments and of the hierarchy. Acts of violence, like beating up Jews. Consequently, in 1349, Clement VI in a bull suppresses all groups of flagellants, but they continue to occur. Let's skip page 20. Take a look at page 21. Middle of the page, you've got Bibles. The Bible in the later Middle Ages was not a closed book. Many lay persons of this period were thoroughly acquainted with all the books of Scripture. Biblical histories are especially popular. But because distorted translations by heretics, Waldensians, Lollards, etc., force strict laws that prohibit reading the scriptures in the vernacular, actual reading of the text tends to decline. Latin Bibles. 1447, Gutenberg invents printing with movable type. 1455, Gutenberg's Bible begins the mass production of books. Catechisms start to appear. Missals start to fall on everybody. Confessional books, aids to confession for the laity, not for the priests, appear. Books of hours, which are various devotions for the hours of the day, Bible histories, rhymed Bibles, and Biblia Pauperum,
become common. These are especially interesting to me. Obviously, Biblia Pauperum means poor person's Bible. If you look at number one there under it, around 1400 to 1450, these became popular. They were rather like a 40 to 50 page comic book. They had five pictures per page of scenes from Jesus' life, and opposite them, the corresponding Old Testament events that presaged various aspects of Jesus' life. So who'd have thought the comic book went that far back? There it is. Well, we made it, troops. And we've even got a little time here for questions.
Several times you mentioned the influence of the ascetics and denying themselves and flagellism. Right. Could that have had any influence by the Muslim practice of beating themselves until they bleed and those kinds of things? Is there any evidence that that had any influence on those movements?
You've got me there because I'm not familiar with that practice in Islam. What have you heard about that?
Just recently on TV, there was one practice that was banned by Saddam, but now they go into the streets and beat themselves till they bleed, and it's evidently a pretty ancient Muslim devotion. Right. I just thought of it. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, that's the Shiites and the Sunnis split in the 650, in the 660s after the death of Ali, who is the fourth caliph, the fourth successor to Muhammad. Muhammad dies in 632, and then 20 years later, the fourth caliph, who's Ali, who all the Shiites are very much in favor of, gets assassinated. And so the Shiites, Shiite means party or sect, break away and refuse to recognize those earlier caliphs. Ali is the first true caliph, true follower. And they refer to him as an imam. And then according to the Shiites, the imams are hereditary descendants of Ali. And since Ali was a relative of Muhammad, these are of the same gene pool as Muhammad. Not elected, not appointed. You got to be within the family of Muhammad himself. When you get to the seventh imam, some of the Shiites stop there and say that was the last of the imams. And so they're called the seveners. Others go on to a 12th imam in, I think, the 1100s, and stop there. A young boy was announced to be the 12th imam, and he disappeared. Nobody knew what happened to him. So the idea became current among the 12ers that he was taken up to God, the way Elijah was, or the way Enoch was. And therefore, he's still there, and he'll come back someday. And therefore, you can't have more imams since then. The Shiites argue that the clerics, like Muqtada al-Sadr and those others that you hear about, the clerical class is in contact with the hidden imam and are being guided by him. And therefore, you need to do what they tell you. Now, as far as this penitential practice, two sons of Ali were also assassinated, not at the same time as Ali, back in the 660s, but within a generation or so, Hassan and Hussein. And therefore, the date of their death is the major holy day for Shiite Muslims. And so, I forget what town it is, might be Karbala, is the pilgrimage site every year where, if you can make it, you go there and you mourn. And so it's in this mourning for Hassan and Hussein that you see that beating. But I'm not aware of that happening throughout the year
or be in a regular practice. That's all I know.
The Sixth Crusade, where it was the only non-military crusade, and yet the emperor got a truce with the Muslims and got some control of the Holy Land. How is he able to do that?
What is it they say? You catch more flies with honey than vinegar? I suppose that's how they were able to do it. I don't know if he went down there by himself, or I don't know any more about it than what's there, so I can't say. But it is interesting, isn't it, that he got more done by talk than by rattling swords.
Page 2, you have a comment next to Innocent III as being the most powerful pope ever. Could you elaborate a little bit more on why he's...
Oh, he lifted weights. He lifted weights.
He lifted weights.
Yeah. Okay. You'll recall, in the last week, we were talking about the 1000s, and we came across this tremendous reform movement at the top of the church. Well, that also occurred, but that's in 1054. And this reform is primarily under Gregory the VII, whose name was Hildebrand, who's in the 1080s, if I remember. And it's because he consolidated the power of the papacy. If you look at the handout from last week, there's an entire page that shows the various ways in which he centralized the power of the hierarchy. And there's another list that shows the ways in which he centralized the power out in the sticks. So by the time he was done, he had grabbed all the reins, and the papacy was extremely powerful. Yeah, amazing, isn't it? But he had lots of reformers helping him, like St. Peter Damian and other people. So when he retires, then you got a century's worth of popes who are riding high at the top of this reform. And the one who winds up most powerful ever is a century later, Innocent III, who's like the 1180s. I think he dies in 1216. So it's a result of that consolidation of power a century earlier that winds him up at the top.
You have a reference in the mid 13th century about after the founding of the Franciscans and the Dominicans.
Yeah.
1250 on, Franciscans and Dominicans in India, then China.
I came across that. Isn't that interesting?
What, they sent missionaries there?
Or? I have to assume so. But I was unaware of that until I did the research for tonight, which is several months ago, and I don't remember what book I was looking at. But that's a darned interesting... But, of course, when was Marco Polo? Wasn't he 1200s? And the Crusades have widened the cosmopolitan view of Western Europe. It's no longer so insular as it had been previously. So I guess we shouldn't be quite that surprised. I normally think of India and China with the Jesuits, exactly, in the 1500s. But I guess this is a precursor of that. Francis Xavier in India and a guy named Matteo Ricci in China, I think, are the two main Jesuits. But we're going to get to those.
Okay. Finishing up right on schedule here.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.